Hello, listeners, and welcome to the 80th episode of the Criterion Reflections podcast. I am David Blakesley, joined today by David Seely, as we're going to resume the conversation we began last September and about the early career of Werner Herzog. David, you were with me to talk about Fata Morgana back in September of 2019, when the Criterion Channel was running kind of a pretty extensive package. I believe it's pretty much mirrors the nice little box set that is a Pino Lorber put out.
Shout Factory.
Oh, Shell Factory. Okay, it's sitting right there. I couldn't see the label. Right. So, but anyways, it was a great package. And even though you can't get the film we're talking about today, Land of Silence and Darkness, on the Criterion Channel, I'm just so intrigued by Herzog's career. And since at least at one point in time, he was part of the Criterion collection and hopefully will be again in the future. We're going to go ahead and take a little bit of time to talk about this very intriguing, somewhat unsettling early documentary work by the great Werner Herzog. So, David, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, David. It's nice to be back. That Fata Morgana episode was my very first ever podcast, so I'm having a little wave of nostalgia here.
That's right. Yeah, I kind of broke you into this world here, and you've become a regular of sorts. We've done a lot of collaboration over the last several months, and I've really appreciated your company as we've analyzed a pretty good range of films.
Yeah.
But it's nice to kind of go back to Herzog there. And so we're going to get to that in a minute, but I also do want to take a moment just to acknowledge the kind of the tumultuous events in my personal life recently. My mother passed away. And man, the emotions are already coming back just uttering those words. But I want to express a very personal note of thanks and appreciation to many of my listeners and podcast partners and, you know, other people who maybe just follow other things I do on social media. The outreach and the support and the expressions of sympathy and condolence are extremely well appreciated. And it's been very meaningful to me just to sort of see how the community cares for the actual people rather than just the, you know, amusement that we provide in our conversations and social media comments and stuff. So, you know, so I just do want to personally thank listeners for, you know, just the many expressions of support and sympathy that I've received. It's made a big difference in kind of lifting up me and by extension, my family through a pretty difficult time. And, you know, I'm 58 years old. My mother was in her late 70s, and that's the stage of life when things like this happen. But boy, it really affected me, and it, in a certain way, I think, you know, prepared me, or maybe gives me a particular angle of approach on this film that deals with people with disabilities and significant handicaps. And my mom was disabled over the last couple of years of her life. She had some pretty significant health issues and mobility. Her sight was, you know, kind of fading as she was getting older, but she, you know, could still see, and her hearing was fine. And deafness and blindness are kind of the main themes of this film. But even just this theme of people who maybe are not as functional or as productive as sort of our mainstream capitalist-oriented Western economies would prefer, where do they fit into society, and what is their life like, and how do they interact with the world, and what purpose do they serve? I mean, these are all kind of implied questions as Herzog puts us in connection with people who are dealing with disabilities and limitations that most of us probably have never really, you know, imagined or seriously considered might happen to us. Maybe there's some people who have or have been touched by blindness and or deafness in their personal life, in their families or whatever. But yeah, this was kind of a, you know, it's a bad play on words, but kind of an eye opener for me. I'll just go ahead and say it, just to really encounter lives that have been severely impacted by disability. And so, yeah, I think we're going to have an interesting conversation. So, David, you know, besides your general appreciation and interest in Werner Herzog, what was it that drew you to want to talk about this film with me today?
Well, I think this is really one of his best and most fascinating and quite moving films, which is not necessarily a word people tend to associate with Werner Herzog. His films tend to be much more sort of intellectual, or at least on the surface. But this one is very emotional and very has a great strain of humanity running through it. This sometimes poetic examination of these people who are, as you say, quite sort of marginalized in society. They have severe disabilities and they're severely challenged in terms of communication with the world around them. And he asks some really, or maybe he doesn't ask them directly, but he certainly makes you think very much about these issues with people, how people like this, how you can imagine yourself in those situations, and you can imagine people whose view of the world and experience of the world is completely, totally different from our own perceptions and our own standard ways of communicating. And I think it's just absolutely fascinating. Having watched it now many times, even just watching it a couple times again the last week or so as we've been preparing for this podcast, I still find the film absolutely engaging and moving on a number of levels. And there's certain moments in it that just still totally transfix me and push all my buttons intellectually and emotionally. So I think it's, for me, it's quite a powerful piece of work.
Yeah, and let's just kind of fit this into Herzog's oeuvre here, because he's, I'm not like a serious student of Herzog, but I've known about him and his reputation and, you know, the kind of films he's made. He makes some pretty intense movies, especially those that he's probably most famous for, or at least that I'm most familiar with, going back to Aguirre, The Wrath of God, Fitzcarraldo, which he's kind of extreme kind of madman type of productions, you know, just the intensity with which he poured himself into these projects and, you know, pushed people to their endurance. And even more recent films like, you know, Grizzly Man, where, you know, it's about a guy who has this very eccentric desire to bond with grizzly bears. And, you know, there's a tragic outcome at the end of the film. And, you know, you just sort of think of Herzog as this kind of intense, hard driving, you know, almost ruthless type of filmmaker because of the kind of subject matter he puts in front of you. And there is a bluntness or a challenging aspect to this. That this is not a comfortable film, especially if you are not accustomed to being with or around people with significant disabilities. You know, you might find yourself viscerally reacting because, especially some of the more severely handicapped children, you know, there's just kind of a, ooh, wow, that it's just kind of unsettling aspect of, you know, just contemplating the deprivations of their lives. And it's not necessarily easy viewing. It's is not just a pop in the DVD and you know, feel amused for, you know, 85 minutes.
And it's not necessarily like a feel good sort of film. But it's
right.
It's never exploitative, though. I mean, what's interesting is that he very much just lets you observe and contemplate the things that you're seeing and the people that you're meeting. And there's always a dignity about them and the way that they're treated in the subject, whereas in other situations you might be more manipulated. I think here he doesn't do any manipulating at all. It's very, he's very, just lets you observe and draw your own conclusions.
Yeah, and I think that's very well stated, because you're right. This isn't an uplifting, inspirational, wow, look at these heroic souls who overcome all the odds and, you know, do something great. This isn't like a Special Olympics. And I'm not slagging any of these types of, you know, efforts, because, you know, disabled people need a break. And if they have champions and advocates out there who are saying these people are doing important, vital things and making a difference, maybe it's in a small, humble way, you know, more power to those types of messages. But he really is kind of just putting the lens in front of some very interesting and very unique types of interactions between people who have to find a way to communicate when the means that almost all of us take for granted, literally the ability to hear what other people are saying, to see them, to visually observe them, their body language, their facial expressions, all the nonverbals, even the voice tones and things that you pick up beyond just the mere words that people speak, they have none of that. And we'll get into the details of how that communication happens. But and if I even go back into a film that we haven't properly covered, but Even Dwarf Started Small, which is another early Herzog work, actually it was before Fata Morgana, and it's part of that same set, but I'd already passed that point in the timeline, so we didn't really cover it. There, I think you can make the claim that at least there was an element of some exploitation of dwarves / midgets and little people, and kind of the antics and some of the kind of wild situations that Herzog put together for that film. In some ways, he was a little less sensitive in that production and much more sensitive here. And I think that's to his credit. Mm-hmm. Maybe he matured a little bit in terms of, treating his subject matter with some dignity. And they were completely different films with different perspectives and objectives as well. David, would you like to just kind of summarize how this film is put together? There's a central figure, Finney Straubinger, as in Lobinger, John Lobinger, one of my beloved guests here, kind of a little similarities of the last names, but she's a very remarkable woman, and it's her very unique experience that I think drives this project. So tell us just a little bit about how this thing is put together.
Well, the film basically follows Miss Straubinger, who is a lady who had a very harrowing accident as a child, and over the course of her teenage years, she just very gradually lost her sight and her hearing, just over the space of many years. And she also spent many years bedridden and under morphine in order to alleviate a lot of pain. And she spent many, many years like this. And it was only later in life that she sort of managed to release herself from that. And she began to go out and support other people who were in the same situation as her, as being deaf and blind. And so she travels around Germany to meet these people and give them her support, and obviously because she has a connection with them, with a shared experiences, she is able to offer them some sort of companionship or communion, community amongst these people. So that's essentially the kind of overview of what the film's about. But it also deals with the experience of these people. And we meet various people along the way who are in different sort of scenarios. You were saying about inspirational. I think obviously Feeney Straubinger in herself is quite an inspirational character, mm-hmm. because she's obviously someone who's, if you can imagine the sort of the psychological trauma and the experience of being a child and growing up and gradually losing your facilities of sight and hearing, it must be quite traumatic and frightening. So the fact that she managed to eventually sort of escape the worst of that and be able to then go back out and take a place in society and go and help and support others and try and build a community is quite an inspirational story. But the film kind of digs deeper in that. It's like you mentioned, I think for me the most powerful bit is the kind of the last third that deals with the children who sort of have, mm-hmm. have these conditions congenitally. They were born deaf and blind. And so it really explores, because these are children whose view and experience of the world would be completely disconnected from our reality. They live a completely almost internalized life. And although there is efforts that they show in trying to teach them some basic forms of communication and making them somewhat self-sufficient in some aspects of their lives. Some of these kids, one in particular, has such a severe disability, and because he grew up in an environment where he wasn't really nurtured or supported very well, he literally lives completely internalized in his own mind almost, and his only sort of stimulus is he kind of self-stimulates himself. And it really makes you think about, because he does this very well in the film by just letting you observe these people. He then, it almost makes you kind of project it onto yourself about thinking about, thinking about these issues and thinking about, obviously the obvious thing is that you would think, oh, well, what would that be like for me if I couldn't see and hear and things, but... Mm-hmm. But some of these children, literally, just the slightest touch is this incredible sort of experience to them. And there's scenes where they have things like where they're standing in a shower, and you can see the reactions that they have to the feeling of the water on their skin, and music especially. There's quite a moving moment where this boy is given a radio, and he just clutches it to his chest in total wonder and amazement, because obviously he can just feel the vibrations of the music coming through the radio, and it's quite a powerful image. And so I think that's kind of what the film is about. It's kind of a contemplation almost on sort of communication and loneliness and resiliency and all these things. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's fine. I mean, really, it is this kind of, and there's kind of an arc there. I think, you know, you've kind of led us towards some of the concluding portions, but, you know, you don't really get that right up front. What you get is the story of this unfortunate woman, you know, who, you know, presumably had a fairly normal childhood developmentally, a bad accident. She said she was a little bit maybe under-supervised by her parents, and that may have led to this disaster that, you know, ultimately robbed her of her two kind of primary senses there. But she can still talk, you know, she talked long enough into her, you know, teenage years that even if she, you know, maybe she can detect her own voice because of the internal, you know, monologue or whatever, but, you know, she maybe had a little bit of hearing or a little bit of her sight, one of the senses, there's just a very small percentage there. So, but she does have the ability, and she is a bit of a, you know, she's not a narrator of the film itself, but she's always talking to the people around her so that, you know, even as she's like doing her little tapping language into the palms of the people that she's, taught how to, you know, decipher this language, it's kind of like this kind of tapping code where, you know, tapping on the fingertips or the palms and certain sequences will spell out words, and there's probably like a sign language, little shortcuts for more common, you know, verbiage and things of that sort. So it's a really interesting, just kind of a sort of a phenomenology of communication. Like, how do you put concepts and ideas together? And so there was kind of just that sort of element as far as, you know, how do impressions, thoughts, ideas, feelings, relationships, you know, kind of course back and forth between two people when our usual means are kind of taken away from us, and that drive to continue to want to communicate. When life becomes more of like a tactile experience, or maybe there's a sensitivity just to feeling the presence of another person. Yeah, I was struck on a couple of occasions where Finney was reuniting with people, you know, who were, again, deaf and blind. And would they be able to just to sort of pick up on some kind of distinctive energy about her? Like, even if she's not touched them yet or communicated them specifically, it's me, would they be sensitive enough just to recognize her presence after having been around her for a certain amount of time? That's a sort of an uncanny thing to think about, how these impressions are shared. But I, you know, in the early portion, what you're seeing is mostly like elderly people who have you know, maybe at later stages of life and less catastrophically, also seeing their senses diminish. And her mission for them seems to be more like, you know, life is still worth living. Because, you know, the question of suicide comes in. I mean, it's not explicitly raised in the film, but yeah, as you were saying, David, when we project ourselves into those types of situations, I mean, you got to think, is life worth living at that point? When, I mean, you know, look at us. We love to watch movies and talk about them, and
yes, and you know, music and all those things, yeah.
Music, all that stuff, right? So for these people, cinema, you know, popular music, classical music. I mean, again, picking up the vibrations may have some sort of excitement to it, some kind of gratification. But my goodness, so much of my life, going back to my childhood, has just been about reading books and, you know, finding interesting things that are happening in the world, and just kind of settling into the ideas and expressions of other people through the written word, the audio of music, the visual and audio blend of cinema. You know, it would be extremely depressing to have all that taken away, you know, and yet Finney is a testament to say, you know what, there's still a lot of life to be lived, and there's a goodness and a quality and a purpose to continuing to go on. And so to me, even just addressing that very existential question is, you know, what's the use? If you can't see and if you can't hear, why bother going on? I mean, that's a pretty deep, you know, subject to contemplate. And I think Herzog, in a kind of implied indirect way, is sort of putting that out there in front of us. And as the story goes on, then we start moving into people who have never had the privilege of hearing or seeing, those boys that you've already described. And so you start from, you know, kind of sad to even sadder. And then the movie kind of comes down to kind of an interesting enigmatic scene towards the end. Maybe we can save that for a little bit. But yeah, what did you think of just the overall sort of the tangent or the arc of the narrative that Herzog put together?
Well, you're absolutely right that the film does have that. It takes you on that journey from people who maybe had to learn to cope with a new situation or the gradual loss, and it's quite striking how reliant they and how strong their memories are, that they mm-hmm. have quite touching sequences where they talk about their memories of things when they do remember seeing and hearing things. There's a scene right at the beginning where she describes remembering seeing some ski jumpers as a child, and mm-hmm. how vividly she remembers the look on their faces. And this would be, you know, something that we, you know, would take for granted and might not necessarily remember, pick up on such specific details. But, I mean, obviously we do that in our memory. We remember very specific mm-hmm. and things, and sometimes really strange little details about things. But to hear someone relate that, and to, for them, that is their whole experience of the outside world, is just in these memories of things that happened to them. You know, and that's quite a striking thing. And then, as you said, as the film progresses, we get to meet people who have had less and less of those memories and those experiences to rely on, and so their whole view and perceptions are going to be completely different. And it just boggles your imagination to think about that, about how if someone is born with that condition and never sees anything, never hears anything, and relies strictly on touch, how even just their own bodies would, their relationship to their own bodies would be completely different and to what we could possibly comprehend.
Yeah, and so, you know, when you get to those younger boys, they are sort of self-stimulating in whatever way they can. And I guess, you know, let's just talk about Vladimir. He's the kind of the most heart-wrenching subject, because, you know, the two younger boys, Harald and, is it Michael? I can't remember the other one's name right offhand, but those two boys were kind of discovered early enough, and, you know, they're going through a process of education. Vladimir, And those boys are like still like in their elementary school years. Maybe Harald is a little bit older, maybe early adolescence or something. It's kind of hard to tell their age because they're not developed the way that, you know, maybe children of their same age, most of their children would even look. But, you know, they're still young. There's still potential there. They're learning language, and there's, you know, some pretty fascinating scenes for anybody who's ever worked with children with disabilities or, you know, even abuse, trauma, neglect victims, the kind of population I've worked with for many years. You recognize, you know, how simple things that, again, so many of us take for granted are really important skills that, you know, when you have to learn them at a later stage of life than when they're typically learned, that the process is just so much more cumbersome. And it just really requires a certain dedication and perseverance and patience to just go over these really fundamental things. And when you're teaching a child to talk by putting his fingers on your throat so that they can feel the vibrations and then try to imitate those vibrations by touching their own neck, it's just like, oh my gosh, this is, I don't know, it's really heroic and amazing, but also it's not the kind of work that just anybody can do, you know. A lot of folks will get extremely exasperated and just give up or just not even want to step into that task in the first place. So, you know, God bless the people who sense that calling and want to give these kids a chance. But for Vladimir, he's at 22 years old at the time we see him in this film, and he was brought up in an extremely neglectful environment. Probably not a cruelly neglectful, but he was raised by his father, who presumably was a man of very limited resources, and maybe just took on the burden of raising this, you know, non-communicative child in his own home, and maybe didn't tell the authorities. There's not a real explanation of how he got this far into the world in terms of, you know, just the years that he lived without anybody understanding what was going on and getting him services. But at this point, he will never be able to learn how to communicate or speak. He's really a body who kind of needs to be managed, but also done in a way that treats him with respect and dignity, because he's a human being. He just has extreme limitations and an inability to really, you know, communicate. I mean, his most direct form of communication with another person is by squeezing his fingers into their body, you know, pinching or clawing at them. And Finny herself gets a few little sharp grabs there, and she reacts to that. And, you know, but again, that may be him expressing affection as much as it is aggression or anything else. You just can't really get into his world. You can only observe it from the outside and wonder what it is he's thinking, or is it even thinking? It's just some kind of a low level functionality there. So just a lot of questions about, you know, life and how much, even with all of our sophistication and all the, you know, the elaborate details and development and the aesthetic refinements and the whole, you know, discipline of education and history and all of that, aren't we doing sort of a version of the same thing? It's just a little bit more, you know, like I say, more sophisticated as we amuse ourselves or put objects in front of ourselves for distraction, contemplation, and communication. I'm certainly not putting down, you know, our mutual expressions of interest and the discussions we have about, you know, topics, objects of art, ideas. But there's a certain reduced level of simplicity that's happening with these people who don't have the full range of senses that the rest of us have. And so it also raises the question, well, what else might we be blind or deaf to in the whole spectrum of reality and the different, you know, energies and vibrations and you know, just all the stuff that's happening around us. We're only tuned in on certain frequencies, it seems. And it's good to understand and appreciate them the best we can. This movie just really just opens up all kinds of fascinating material for philosophical contemplation. At least that's been my response to it, watching it in my present circumstances where I'm, you know, contemplating and experiencing the loss of a dear loved mother and family member.
Yeah, I mean, for me too, the film just really kind of really brings out my imagination in thinking about those things, especially with those young kids. I think obviously that was the most affecting part of the film for me. I mean, it's all wonderful, but that end bit especially, and you mentioned the very ending of the film, which I don't know if you want to talk about that, but that is such a beautiful and poetic moment of this man who we meet towards the end of the film, who I believe they said he lived for several years in a cow shed. He's someone who lost his facilities there kind of a bit later on in life, kind of in his mid to late 30s. And then he just became quite socially marginalized, and apparently he lived under some quite bad conditions. But there's a moment at the end of the film where as some of the others are talking and just sort of milling around having a chat after a meeting or something, he kind of just wanders off in this little sort of back garden of this facility where they've had this meeting, and it's one of those beautiful Herzog moments where he just kind of notices this and trains the camera on this thing that's just going off in the side that most people might not have even noticed. But this man is just sort of finding his way through the garden, and he comes across a tree, and he has this sort of beautiful moment of just examining this tree just with his hands. And I think if you came into the film just at the end and just saw that bit, even just seeing it in isolation, it would be this totally fascinating bit of film of this man and kind of in communion with this tree. But obviously, through the course of the film, we've built up a knowledge about their experiences and things, so it makes it that much more sort of touching and powerful to see this man sort of examining this object with such fascination and overwhelmed with curiosity, and touching the sensory experience of just meeting this tree is such a fascinating sort of image and powerful moment that for me it's just kind of that cap of caps off such an amazing experience.
Well, it's a such an incredibly intuitive moment. Like you say, there's actually a woman speaking as this scene unfolds, and a more conventional filmmaker probably would have just kept the camera on her because she's speaking and she's giving us information. But while the audio is recording her, the camera just kind of wanders off, and it's very light, but it's fluid and elegant. And the man, they're kind of in this kind of contained courtyard area, because like at first you think, holy cow, this guy shouldn't just be wandering off, but he's walking slowly and presumably kind of tentatively, because he's not just going to be charging off and running into something and bonking his forehead into or tripping over whatever. So he's kind of walking, but there's no cane, there's no he's not putting his hands out in front of him to try to run interference or catch whatever might be in his way. He's just kind of slowly strolling, and you get a sense that he's kind of walking away because he's a little frustrated. There's a sense of resignation, maybe even bitterness. And again, who can blame some of these folks for feeling like life has really screwed them over? They've drawn a bad hand. And why? What did they do to deserve this? And why do they have to live out their days under this kind of deprivation? But as he kind of makes his way, he kind of sort of randomly encounters this tree, and he even embraces it at one point, just rubbing his hands, and you're just sensing the texture itself is probably a source of some pleasure. He's feeling the leaves, he's kind of running his hands up and down the branches. So you can tell that he is on some aesthetic level appreciating this tree, and maybe even recalling in his mind's eye what a tree like that might look like. I mean, you know, but he's not speaking anything. It's all, you know, very subtle, very nonverbal. And then after, you know, the camera has kind of run its course, it's just a nice little kind of, you know, swivel up into the sky, into this bell tower. And that's pretty much the end of the film. And it's really beautiful, you know, because it is one of those things where the first time I watch it, it's like, so how is this going to wind up? You know, what's going to be the, you know, kind of the sealing moment of all of this? Because there are some other pretty, you know, impressive and memorable scenes. But I just wondered, how is he going to land this thing? And I think he does it quite brilliantly. I think that little segment is kind of a standalone short film all on its own, even if you don't know the whole backstory. But you understand this man is blind and deaf. Yeah, it's meaningful, you know. Now, what are some other scenes? I maybe one other scene I want to kind of draw attention to is the scene at the petting zoo. There were some pretty incredible moments there. I'll talk about the chimp, you know, who was, you know, again, sort of a humanoid type of figure. I mean, the limbs and the and just that ability to really get vigorous and playful and right up in their business, you know. I don't think the chimp would understand the concept of blindness or deafness, or that this group of people that he was playing with had that particular disability. But it was pretty delightful to watch them encountering other life forms, where I would imagine for the most part, you know, maybe some of them have like a pet cat or a dog or something like that. But, you know, to really just kind of get into wildlife like that, what an amazing experience that had to have been. And it was quite amazing for me just to kind of watch the liveliness of these interactions, just sort of think about what was going on in those moments.
Yeah, it's really nice. And those moments and like the sequence where they take them up in an airplane and all those things, the things that we would sort of take for granted or maybe not think too much about. It's nice in the film that you suddenly do see these things from a different perspective. Because you just, a scene of people going and boarding on a plane normally wouldn't in and of itself be that interesting, probably, I guess, depending on mm-hmm, the context. Mm-hmm. But because they, when they approach the plane, they touch the surfaces and they and the feeling that, you know, you think about that. What would it feel like for someone in that position to feel that liftoff of an airplane off the mm-hmm, runway and all mm-hmm. those things? So it really makes you think about very sort of mundane, if you will, circumstances, and you see them in a completely new perspective, which is just it's one of the great powers of the film, I think.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's a lot of really fascinating moments and exchanges. You know, there's also some things that, you know, maybe Herzog could have dug into more. I mean, this is one where I wouldn't mind a commentary, because if you just sort of do the math, Fini Straubinger lived, she was, I think, around 55 when this film was made. So thinking it was probably 69, 70, maybe early 71 when Herzog put this together. So that would put her as born around 1920-ish or something, or, you know, and or in the 19-teens, maybe even during the World War I years. So she's lived through some pretty, you know, pivotal years in German history, but none of that's really touched upon. You know, how did she, with all of her disabilities, you know, not get some kind of negative treatment? Maybe it's because of her ethnicity, or maybe that's one of the reasons she was bedridden, you know, is that just kind of out of sight, out of mind, and she's not going to be, you know, disposed of, if you will, by certain authorities who feel like those types of people are just a drain on the master race, or whatever their ideology might have been regarding disabled people. And there's also that little presentation by a German politician. I'm not exactly sure what his role was, but he was some kind of a VIP government spokesperson who was giving a speech about recognizing the rights and the humanity of the disabled, which I think was kind of an important message as the, you know, disability rights movement was really starting to get some traction in Western society.
That might be a good segue into a little bit of the background of how the film came to be, because that sequence that you mentioned was actually how Herzog met Fini Straubinger. That he went, he was making another film that was called Handicapped Future, which again just shows the diversity of the type of work he did, especially in the early years, is that he was commissioned to make a documentary, presumably for television, advocating for disabled rights. Because apparently at the time in Germany, they were a little bit behind the curve in terms of disabled access and all these things that are fairly standard now. So he was making a film in order to advocate for better resources for disabled people. And he was filming at that event. And those scenes where you see Feeney sitting with her companion and they're talking with that sort of hand language that you were mentioning mm-hmm. before, he noticed that and he asked his cameraman to take some, without their permission, presumably, he just said, can you take some footage of these people? Because it's quite fascinating to see them. Mm-hmm. What are they doing? And then he obviously approached her afterwards and had a conversation with her. And that's what led to the making of this film, Land of Silence and Darkness, because apparently he struck up a great friendship with this woman. And spent a lot of time, many months, not living with her, but spending a lot of time with her, and they developed quite a great friendship, and that's the genesis of the film.
Well, that's another just kind of a fascinating little insight into Herzog, his curiosity about things that are going on in the world around him. And let's face it, Fanny Straubinger is an amazing person. I mean, she's at a stage of life where you could, especially given all of the limitations and setbacks that she'd had to work through, she could have just sort of hung it up. I mean, the energy that she has and her really passionate mission to reach out and connect with people who have similar handicaps to her, and to, give them that sense that, hey, there are good things to be experienced in this life. Don't give up. Persevere. Again, I mean, this is another aspect of her character that brought my mom to mind. And I don't want to go on too long with that, but both because it's kind of personal and also just because, I want to keep my focus on the film here. But yeah, my mom was also a woman who did not let her physical difficulties slow her down or discourage her. She, in fact, we had to tell her to take it easy, and she just kept on going. So, just some really admirable qualities about the life and the vitality of the central figure of this film. So,
and I think it shows you why Herzog is such a unique filmmaker as well, because like you were saying, he didn't choose to just tell the story in a standard linear fashion and touch right. on just an obvious sort of point by point history. And then this happened and then this happened and this happened. Instead, he makes a film that kind of touches on the bigger sort of ideas and the larger I don't know how to say it. He gets more metaphysical about it, but not in a far out way, because the film is very straightforward and it's very accessible, but he touches on some very profound ideas and sometimes in very simple ways. And I think that's what makes it unique and so much more fascinating.
Yeah, he's not pedantic. He's not lecturing. He's not, I kind of got into some of my sort of more esoteric or metaphysical types of, applications of the story. But he's not really throwing that out there. If you just want to, watch this film as a very simple, here's how people are coping with adversity, and that's about the beginning and end of it. Well, there's certainly plenty to be considered on that level, and people who maybe have a slightly different kind of interpretation of the reality or whatever think I'm getting a little bit too out on the fringes there. Oh, that's fine. Everybody has their own little system for extracting meaning from things like this. So he really does let the people and the camera do the talking, and puts it out there on a platter for the viewer to draw value. And again, there may be some people who don't necessarily enjoy this film. I will give it a strong recommendation because I think it's a film that touches on really core issues of our humanity. But if you're not looking for that type of an object to contemplate, you want to just watch a film that's a little bit more with a story, with entertainment value, with kind of something you can kind of gather your friends around and kind of dig into and have a kind of a rollicking good time, that this may not be that movie. This is maybe a little bit more solo watching. And it might even be, I'm not sure I've ever watched the movie straight front to back in one sitting. And a lot of it's just been the disruptions and activities of the past few weeks. And there is a little bit of a dryness to it, I suppose. But, I think it works effectively when you break it down into segments because there are distinct chapters. There's kind of black text cards that kind of come up to kind of get us from one kind of situation to another. So you could even consider it kind of an anthology of short films, all with kind of some common characters, in particular Finney herself, kind of linking them all together. So it's a movie that I think has a maybe more of a personal application. It'll work better for some folks than for others, but I'm really glad that we took the time to talk about this. Any moments or other situations, segments that you want to draw attention to before we wrap things up, David?
I've touched on a few of them. There's certainly that wonderful moment when she visits that lady in the sort of, I guess they refer to it, I think, as an asylum, but it's not the kind of a term we would use nowadays. And she's obviously someone who's become much more withdrawn, and
she was the woman who was kind of could communicate with her mother, but nobody else. Like they had a sort of a private language of some sort that they had worked out. But when her mother passed away, society just didn't know what to do with her. So they stuck her in this kind of institutional setting where she didn't really fit in there, but it was a place she could stay,
Yeah, and I think those scenes are quite moving, and that woman, because Feeney is trying to make some sort of connection with this woman, who is, as I said, become very withdrawn into herself. But what's also interesting about the sequence is that Herzog, very often, again, his camera sort of shifts focus to some of the other people who are in the room, and who are obviously, it's implied that they must have some mental health issues or they've ended up in this sort of care facility for people with various issues. And he just finds little interesting things that the people are doing or the way that they're reacting. And he just spends a few moments just sort of picking up on these little details. And again, it's not really in an exploitative way, although there is one sequence where he has them all lined up on the beds, and it's obviously a composed picture, but it's quite striking and interesting. I could see why he did it, but I think it's just, again, just those little moments, and what's the strength of his films always is just the fact that he always manages to sort of take your focus away from the obvious thing and just shifts it over to something else that's going on over there and makes you look at it in a completely different way.
He's kind of given visual context and saying, this isn't just an interaction between two people. There's a whole scene going on here. And he just wants to kind of give you the lay of the land, even while the audio might be filling you in on what's going on.
Yeah, exactly.
How are the other people reacting to that?
I mean, a good way of putting it, because he does, that's essentially what he's doing, is he's showing you the bigger picture. He's sort of contextualizing rather than focusing specifically on the subject. He's showing the wider environment and little elements and sort of little details that you might not otherwise get from another filmmaker who was in that same situation. So that's what's quite great about it, I think. Is it all right too if I just mention about, because I'm not sure whether it's where it kind of fits in the scope of your Reflections podcast, but obviously this film is a template philosophically for what I think is Herzog's best film, which is The Enigma of Caspar Hauser. I'm not sure whether that was part of the Criterion package and whether you'll cover that in a separate show. But I think,
well, I'll look it up a minute. Just tell us about
well,
it.
Well, it's a story, and you can see the direct sort of connection with the film that we're talking about tonight, in that it is a film about that's based on a true story, apparently, about a young man who basically was raised by his father, who had just kind of shoved him in a horse stable or something, and just left him there. And obviously this man just grew up in this environment where all he knew was he was chained in a room with hay on the ground, with no external stimuli of any kind. And then at a certain point, this man just decides, oh, I've got to get rid of this kid. And he takes him and just sort of drops him off in the forest, to presumably to leave him to die. But then what happens is that the villagers find him and bring him in, which is obviously the humane thing to do, bring him into their mm-hmm. home. And but it kind of deals with the same sort of central ideas, is that this person grew up completely with none of the perceptions of life and the world that we would take for granted. And it's sort of a fish out of the water situation, where this person is then put into this community with all its kind of rigid conformity and social conditioning and all these things, and how this person with a completely different perspective sort of observes this and experiences this situation. And I think, as I said, it's one of my favorite Herzog films. I think it's one of his best ones. And the reason I bring it up is because The Land of Silence and Darkness was obviously a direct sort of inspiration for that film, mm-hmm. which is like a fictional sort of drama film.
Yeah, well, I just went through my little Shout Factory booklet here, and it is in there. It's a 1974 mm-hmm. release, so I guess that would be on the docket a few seasons from now.
Oh, so it may be a while.
So, yeah. Well, yeah, that's fine. I don't think you spoiled anything. I think it's a great connection. I have not seen it myself. Like I say, I've dabbled a little bit in Herzog, but I've got a lot more discovery yet ahead of me. So that's an intriguing connection. And I did see the film referenced in a few of the reviews and essays I've read, and those links are in the show notes. So
okay.
That's probably a good place to kind of wrap things up then, is kind of where does this lead to in Herzog's filmography? And we will be coming back with, like I say, with Aguirre, The Wrath of God, in the 1972, our next season.
Excellent.
And speaking of that, we are kind of making some progress here. We are kind of down to the last, I don't know, 6-7 features, and then there's going to be a year-ending short film. So maybe by June, well, probably not June, but maybe July, sometime this summer, we may actually get through 1971.
Wow,
yeah. So pretty excited about
that. Has it actually taken you more than a year to get through the year?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've had I've had vacations. I've had different things happen. And the fact is, though, these are all really great movies. It's an incredible lineup of very worthwhile films coming up over the next several weeks and episodes.
Well, your podcast has very much demonstrated that. Obviously, 1971 yeah. was quite a colossal year in cinema, wasn't it?
Yeah, we've got some great stuff coming up. Now, our next episode is going to be kind of going back to Criterion Channel material. It's going to be three films that are in a collection that just got released on the channel. I think they've been on the channel since the beginning of May, but Criterion kind of put up the package of films on their splash page. It's a collection of feminist films from the 1970s under the banner Tell Me. And I think this was a festival or kind of a retrospective showcase that toured in theaters maybe the last year or two. But I'm going to be interviewing a couple of young women from a podcast that I've recently discovered, and we're going to be talking about these three films from 1971 and 72 called Growing Up Female, Jane East Janey, and Joyce at 34. So I'm really looking forward to getting a couple new voices in the mix here, and also just talking about the feminism of the early 70s and maybe how that speaks to both men and women of some 50 years later. So pretty excited about that. I'll be recording that episode pretty soon.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like a really, that's great. I'll look forward to that, definitely.
Yeah, Well, I'm definitely, and I am. I'm happy to be back in the groove. It's been a pretty profound week of mourning and family coming together and just really thinking about all the things that make up a person's life and how we become the people we are due to the influences of those who raised us and loved us. So, yeah, I'll just kind of wrap things up on this wistful note. And thank you all for listening. We'll be coming back at you really soon. I'm going to try to get this episode edited and out there pretty quick so I've got time for the next one to come out right after that. So thanks again for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you real soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.